Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back to the World at H12. My name is Alan, and this week we have Roger Chickering on the podcast. And we are going to talk about Wilhelm II, the last Kaiser. And what do you think has come to the mind of people when they hear about Wilhelm II? And what do you think has first captured popular imagination of him?
Well, I think it corresponds pretty much to the impression that he made himself at the time, which is to say that he was a kind of very loud, very boisterous, very provocative man who enjoyed very much being in the spotlight, so that he was the face of Imperial Germany, certainly during the last 25 years of that regime. And I have the impression that that's probably what most people think when they think of, well, what we used to call over here Kaiser Bill.
So let's begin with his childhood. And of course, to understand anyone how they end up being, we kind of have to go back to the childhood. And as normal in the Hohenzollern family, he did not necessarily get on well with his father in the early years, did he?
Well, no. But the probably the more important of his two parents was his mother, a very, should we say, comprehensively involved woman, who was also the daughter of the English Queen Victoria. And she had the support of her husband in this, was determined that William was going to become a liberal empire, and that he was going emperor, and he was going to steer the German political system in the direction of a parliamentary regime, much like the monarchy. But it must be said, this whole story was extraordinarily complicated by the circumstances in which Kaiser Wilhelm was born. Born as not as the Kaiser, but the Kaiser to be. During the course of his birth, it was a breech birth. He had to be forcibly extracted from the womb, in the course of which he suffered nerve damage in his shoulder and upper neck, with the result that he had a withered arm with which he lived for the rest of his life. This was something that his mother in particular found terribly distressing, because she believed it was going to limit him in what he was able to do, and certainly limit the impression he was going to make. So she undertook in her rearing of him to make sure, or to try to make sure, that he would excel in everything that he did, cost what it might. And it was an extraordinarily painful childhood for the boy, both physically and mentally, in that he always found himself for striving after things that he felt that he couldn't do. And it's a tribute to his determination that he turned out to be as physically agile as he was. But the impact of this constantly striving after an unattainable ideal of him own, of himself, has clearly played out, or clearly played out in his adult behavior as well. Amongst other things, it's a case of his trying to find approval from others by always being in the limelight. If you want to put, the psychiatric name on it, it's called narcissism. There's a very good book on exactly this on this subject by the son of the psychiatrist Hans Kohut. This is Tom Kohut, whose book William and the Germans makes this case very strongly that his narcissism was the governing force in his behavior.
No, it's my understanding that, like you said, it did not get along very well with his father, but it did seem to get along well with his grandfather, who was not the Kaiser at the time, but the King of Prussia, because it wasn't unified until 71. And again, if I may refer to our episode with James J. Sheehan, in where we talked about the Prussian Empire, it is, of course, the King of Prussia, still not Kaiser of Prussia, his grandfather, Wilhelm the First.
Well, he did get along well with his grandfather, probably better than he did his own father, who didn't get along so well with his father in turn. But the father was a more remote presence in his growing up. There's no question, but his mother was the dominant figure. And the grandfather then died when Wilhelm was, what, 18 or 19 years old. At which point he had faced an entire life in which he was being groomed, as it were, in two different settings, the one at home by his mother, which was politically directed towards his becoming a liberal representative of a constitutional monarchy, the other being the Prussian royal court, and you're quite right about that, where the influence was very much on the military and the value, the virtue of the military and authoritarian values that were prominent in the Prussian and then in the German monarchy.
Of course, I'm talking a little bit about Otto von Bismarck as well, because he does help the young Kaiser to be, that he is still to help him shape his image as well, that he when during his childhood. And I do believe they travel to Russia together as well at some points.
I don't know that, but it could very well be. Bismarck had several things in mind in his dealings with the young man. The first of which was to make a loyal Bismarckian out of him, which is to say that Bismarck anticipated ruling under him and wanted to make sure, or to assure, that he, Bismarck, would have a relationship with the young Kaiser that he had had with the Kaiser's grandfather.
And this would backfire, of course, as we will see later.
Yes, that certainly did backfire. It should be said that William's father shared his mother's views about the virtues of a parliamentary liberal system. And there's little doubt that he, had he not died early and remained monarch, he was only in his late 40s when this all happened, he would have soon broken with Bismarck, and Bismarck knew it. So the idea was to make sure that the son of the son had a better, say, a better posture with regard to the authoritarian aspects of the constitutional system.
So that's because it does go to send them away, because as we talked about, so Prussia was a military state, and it's often said that Prussia was a military with a state, that's a state with a military. But then his father and mother, it's my understanding that they tried to send him away on board, is to get away from the military aspect of the Prussian rule. Is that something?
In particular, his mother, I believe. Well, you see, the influences are going in two different directions here. So it's a kind of competition for the heart and soul of the young boy during the course of his education. It seems likely that the tensions between the mother and the son predisposed the young William more and more towards the direction of the Prussian court, and lest it be forgotten, the army itself. In other words, he entered the army as an 11 or 12 year old boy in various capacities, and he's undergoing real military training to the extent that he is able from a very early stage in his life.
And there's something else as well. You mentioned Queen Victoria, and I want to talk a little bit about this as well before we go into it later, I'm sure. Is that, of course, you have three cousins that will rule the throne of England, and that is, of course, I don't remember the English king's name, but Nicholas II and Wilhelm, and of course, the King of England as well. They are all three cousins that will later rule the throne.
Yeah, well, the king was George V, who was the son of Edward VII, who was in turn Uncle Edward to William II, as well as to Nicholas II of Russia.
So let us talk about, because I feel like we have to talk about this as well, the brief 90 days reign of Wilhelm's father. And I want to talk a bit about, because nobody really took him. It's my understanding that he was already dying at this point, and nobody really took him very seriously. So they more or less took orders from his son, Wilhelm II. But let's talk a little bit about his reign. Did he accomplish anything during his 90-day reign?
Nothing of any particular importance. The problem was, as you said, it was clear that he had throat cancer, advanced throat cancer, when he took the throne. And that also meant that he could not talk, which meant made it very difficult for the statesman to deal with him. And the longer he ruled, the more incapacitated he became. And it lasted, as you said, about 3 months. And very little was accomplished at the time in the anticipation that a new ruler was going to take the throne.
So did Wilhelm II dictate things kind of as a regent, in a way, under Frederick III's reign?
My impression is that Bismarck was still very much the principal person in the government at that time, and he remains so, albeit with increasing tension with his chancellor or his minister president, as his own reign advanced. And as things turned out, it wasn't even 2 years William II and Bismarck were, as it were, joint regents in this whole thing. Excuse me, because Wilhelm fired him in March of 1890.
Let's talk about the firing of Bismarck. Didn't the kind of Bismarck see it coming that he wouldn't remain? And let's talk about Bismarck's successor as well, and how what was it like for him to take over the. Not a throne, but the takeover as Iron Chancellor after the legendary Bismarck's reign over Prussia.
Well, okay. There are a number of aspects to this whole thing. What everyone had come to think of the relationship between the monarch and his principal statesman when Germans were thinking about this subject in 1888, as the new monarch took the throne, had been determined entirely by the relationship between Bismarck and William I. And the reign of Frederick III, William's father, was not long enough for there to be any patterns established on how the new monarch and Bismarck were going to interact, although lots of statesmen and other observers were anticipating that it would be a very tense relationship, as it was really almost from the start. The new monarch was a headstrong young man was quite clear to everybody who had known him. The two of them managed to get along reasonably well, Bismarck trying to reestablish the relationship he had had with William's grandfather, and William trying very much to resist this, figuring that he was going to become eventually, in effect, his own chancellor.
So what are some of the things Wilhelm do when it first finally acquired, you might say, acquired the throne? Because it's quite young compared to Russian, sorry, not Russian, but Prussian monarchs, because most Prussian monarchs are quite old when they regain the throne. But I believe Wilhelm II is just 27 when he became Kaiser of, 27, 28 years old when he became Kaiser of Prussia.
Yeah, well, one of the effects of his upbringing was that he was a man of supreme confidence or faith in his own abilities, and that he chafed under Bismarck's attempts to, what should we say, guide him in the realms of statesmanship. And it wasn't long before very touchy issues came up over which the two men clashed, the first being a very large strike of German miners in the Ruhr area, which Wilhelm was being counseled to send in the army. And Wilhelm himself said, "This is not a good sign if I now, as one of the first acts in my reign, send the soldiers in to shoot miners, because I would like to be thought the emperor of all my people." And thus he did something that would have been inconceivable by his grandfather. He actually received a delegation of the striking miners and asked them about their grievances and said that he sympathized with them, but that he did not like the idea that they were followers of the Social Democrats. Well, Bismarck was appalled by this because he was persuaded that the way to deal with socialist workers was to extend the series of laws that had basically outlawed the Social Democratic Party, which was up for renewal in 1890. It was on this issue that the two men, William II and Bismarck, frontally clashed. And Wilhelm said, basically, "No, we're not going to do it." Bismarck thereupon says, "Well, then I'm going to resign." A trick that he had pulled many times with the grandfather, and the grandfather always said, "I cannot rule without Bismarck." And this Wilhelm said, "Well, I'd be delighted to rule without you." And he accepted the resignation, and that was that.
Now, what about his successor, Bismarck's successor? Who does he hire in his place?
Well, first of all, the choice of a successor was entirely his, and he knew it. He also knew that, practically speaking, he was in a position to do a great deal of things by the terms of the Constitution, that he did have far-reaching autocratic powers, including naming all of his both his Imperial German and his Prussian officials. And so he looked around and he found someone who looked to be ideal, a man of extensive military background in both the army and the navy, and a man known for not being a particularly loud fighter. His name was Leo von Caprivi. William calculated that he would be much better suited to be a kind of aide rather than
a yes man.
Yeah, well put. And for the most part, that's what Caprivi was willing to do.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about his the alliance, because it, of course, as we will talk about more in the future, one of the more famous alliance of the late Prussian reign of Wilhelm II is, of course, the Ottoman Prussian alliance and Ottoman German alliance, if you will. So let's talk a little bit about how this alliance came about. And I want to bring up, and we talked a little bit about this in our episode on the rise of Turkey as well, and where it makes sense that Ottoman Turkey wanted to be alliance with Prussia because they had no interest in the Middle East, right? Whereas France and Britain at the time, they were very much interested in carving up the empire. So the alliance made sense because it's my understanding that Germany at the time did not have really any interest in the Middle East. They had their own colonies in Africa to worry about, and that wasn't more enough for them, my understanding. So let's talk a little bit about the Ottoman Turkey alliance, how this came about.
It came about in October 1915, after the outbreak of the war. And let's say not all of the geopolitical influences pointed in that direction, because one of the complicating factors is that Germany's principal ally by this time was Austria-Hungary. Which also had its own issues in the Balkans, so that the Austrian-Turkish tensions were not inconsiderable as well. But the German interests in that part of the world had to do with, well, a kind of counterweight to Russia in the East. Strategically, it looked to be a valuable thing. And about this time, the German fleet, like other fleets, were beginning to switch to oil as the principal fuel. The Turkish connection promised to ease the access to Middle Eastern oil. So by this time, the idea of a German presence in the Ottoman Empire had become a particularly attractive thing, particularly given the German project to build a railway that would stretch all the way to Basra in what is today Iraq.
And I want to talk a little bit about as well because Wilhelm does travel to Ottoman lands and visit Egypt, and of course, the famous tomb of Saladin is one of the famous stories surrounding Wilhelm II as well. So let's talk about Wilhelm II's travel to the Middle East and the diplomatic goal of this journey, what that the diplomatic goal was, where.
Well, it was 1903, and the principal site of his visit was Jerusalem, at a time in which it was under the Ottoman rule. And it was Wilhelm's desire at this time, as he said explicitly, that he was going to become the champion of Islamic peoples around the world. Another thing that caught headlines. It mystified some of his own advisors, but it made quite a stir and sort of set this theme in the Kaiser's mind that his presence in that part of the world was expected and would be welcome.
So that, what was the because there is a story behind him, like I said, when he visited the tomb of Saladin. So that is one of the more famous stories of his travel to the Middle
Yeah.
East. So let's talk a little bit about his story visit to Saladin's tomb as well.
Well, I don't know much more about it than that he visited it.
Because isn't there a famous photograph of him standing by the tube? So, or am I wrong that I believe there is a photograph of him there, isn't there?
I believe there is too.
So I want to talk a little before we go into First World War. I want to talk a little bit about army commanders, and of course we're going to talk about some of the famous army commanders of the time. And I want to bring up the three people mainly. That is, of course, Helmut von Moltke the Younger and the Hindenburg, and of course the famous Ludendorff, who all three, and both all three of them will be, of course, essential under World War I.
You don't want to forget Schlieffen.
Of course not. Never.
Schlieffen was hired in 1891 as chief of the general staff, so William was in power then.
But I want to talk a little bit about the role, of course, in preparation of the army and, Ludendorff and Hindenburg and Helmut von Moltke the Younger as well, and talk a little bit about them under and their role in the building of the army and then German Navy. Because before World War One, the German Navy, I think, was the second only to Britain before the World War One started.
Well, it depends on what date you're talking about. The German fleet became, by its size, number two in the world only in 1907. It was something like 10th, or I'm just making this up, but it was an inconsiderable fleet in 1897, when the major push to establish Germany as a sea power began.
So let's talk about the outbreak of World War One, and I want to bring something up because I want to have your view on this because there's a historian when the Archduke Ferdinand was shot, that he believed that if Austria had invaded almost immediately as a casus belli to that, there would have been much more sympathy. Instead, since they waited, so long to invade, and they discussed the World War One could have been avoided, that if they had invaded almost immediately, that should, the World War One could have been avoided. Is there truth to this? That what do you think about this?
This is a terribly important problem, but may I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
That we have jumped into the First World War, and there are a whole bunch of really important things that happened before the First World War
Yeah.
that make Wilhelm's behavior in the First World War make a lot more sense. Can
Of course,
I?
yeah, go ahead.
Can I be so bold as to suggest a brief look at what the historians have had to say about William II?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I
go
think
ahead.
it'll help make sense of a lot of these things that we're getting into. You know,
Yeah.
it's what we call historiography, but it's the history of the history of William II, if you like. Can I say a word or two about
Oh
that?
yeah, of course, be my guest, absolutely.
Okay. After Bismarck's dismissal that you asked about a little bit ago, and then with the increasingly turbulent period of German diplomacy after Bismarck's departure, and then after the First World War, especially, it became common amongst not only historians but many Germans themselves, to define William II as sort of the catastrophe of German history, who squandered the great legacy of Bismarck. Bismarck being solid, well considered, smart, ruthless, but always careful. Wilhelm being the exact opposite, you see, careless, loud, unthinking, unsteady, so that Wilhelm, in a sense, has been made the scapegoat for everything that happened towards the end of Imperial Germany. This was a view that was repeated immediately after the Second World War by a German historian by the name of Erich Eick, who really took the charge and systematized it, saying, "In William II, you have an explanation for everything that came afterwards," so that in a sense, William can be seen as the essential transition to the Hitler regime. Now, what happened in the 1960s of 50 years ago, and I don't know whether other people whom you've talked to have said anything about this, is that this idea was of William II being the source of all the problems. It was challenged by a number of German historians, the most important of whom was named Fritz Fischer. Has his name come up in this in your podcast before?
No, I don't think so. No.
Well, basically what Fischer argued was that the war guilt clause in the Treaty of Versailles, that Germany bears sole responsibility for all of the damage, that it was basically right. And that if anything, the charges against William II were too lenient. The Germans in the July crisis had systematically set out on a program of European conquest. They knew absolutely what they were doing in July 1914, and that they did in fact bear the guilt for the First World War. However, what made this particularly interesting is that Fischer had very little to say about William himself. Instead, he puts the blame on the chancellor at the time, Theobald von Bethmann Hollweg, and said he was the evil genius behind this, and that he had embraced foreign policy goals much like those of Hitler, this in July of 1914. Well, this then set the stakes in the debate among German and other historians for the next 10 or 20 years, actually. And it emphasized not only Bethmann Hollweg's personal role, but the kind of institutional and economic pressures that had led to it. The fact that there were aggressive statesmen throughout the German bureaucracy, the fact that there were very loud pan-German and other nationalists who had access to people in power, and particularly since the role of German banks and heavy industry, then the aggressive aims of these people were also prominent in the German system, so that there were a lot of structural things that went into this whole story. Wilhelm, in this vision, becomes kind of a parenthetical, a marginal figure in the whole business. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the historiography of William II since that time has been really, really dominated by one man. And this is John Rurl, who may be
familiar. Yeah, yeah.
Who became the world's leading authority on William II and spent his life studying William II, who produced, before he died, alas, 2 months ago, produced a biography of some 5,000 pages in which he traced down every conceivable documentary lead that he could find anywhere, I mean literally anywhere in the world he could find it. And he said, Fischer basically has this absolutely wrong. William II was in fact the heart and soul of this whole regime. He wielded a near absolute power whenever he wanted to. And his great achievement was to put all of his lackeys in positions of power so that he himself was the single most important figure in the whole story. Well, Rurl's book is a fascinating thing to read. Well, it's a long read. It's been published in three volumes in both.
Might take a while.
It will take a while. Fortunately, he also in 2014 published a slim volume of about 150 pages in which he summarizes the whole thing. And it's a good book to read along with Christopher Clark's, for one thing, because the two men saw things in quite different terms. I will say that the judgment now, at least my judgment on the work of John Rurl, it's important for what we're talking about today, is that for all of his devotion to studying the Kaiser, he actually presents a rather skewed view of his importance. In other words, he himself has so concentrated on the life of William that he overestimates. He loses sight of the constraints on Wilhelm. He presents a portrait of Wilhelm, the manipulator, the man who was able to manipulate all those in his environment and to control them, and has overlooked the extent to which the people whom he appointed learned to manipulate him. So that some of the most fateful decisions that were made in the course of his reign have to be re-examined carefully to find out, well, who was influencing whom.
Now I want to ask, what's your take on this? What do you think about the, what Chittering and Grow? What is your stance here, Wilhelm?
Well, I have to say that I've always admired John Rule. He was a wonderful man, and I was very fond of him. But I really do think he was wrong. And frankly, I found Christopher Clark's book, the one you read, a much more balanced and credible view, because he poses specifically the problem that in many cases, William's advisors were manipulating him rather than the other way around. And I'd say if I were to recommend to a student a single book to read on William II, then Chris Clark's is certainly the best one to do. Although, in all fairness to John Rule, I would also recommend a look at the short one.
Maybe not the long one in the first time. But that's thought. I hope you understand now a little bit of the mentality and, of course, of Wilhelm II. So let's go underworld World War I, and what is, because as you know, we talked about Christopher Clark's work, it does seem to me that Wilhelm II's actual involvement in the World War I, as like what Allied, and we will talk about this as well, what Allied propaganda make it seem, Wilhelm II actually did not have that much involvement in the actual war strategy, and you know how what he were going on the theater of war.
Well, in my view, the First World War is in a sense a fitting climax to the rule of William II, because in many respects some of the themes that were already in operation during his peacetime reign reached a climax during the First World War. I do believe that many of his central advisors recognized just how unreliable and how erratic the man was. He was also indiscreet. He would say terrible things in public, embarrassing, humiliating many people who had been in his confidence. It also suggests that he severely overestimated his own capabilities, his own skills, and his own knowledge. And many of his advisors, certainly before the First World War, had learned that you control him primarily by keeping things from him. I think in this respect, probably the major turning point is what happened in 1908 in connection with the Daily Telegraph affair. I don't know whether that is anything that you're listening.
Yeah, please bring it up. Yeah.
Wilhelm was by this time well noted for his indiscretions, his public indiscretions, and they seem to have reached a high point when in November 1908, he allowed the publication of an interview he had had with a British journalist, during which he said a number of astonishing and untruthful things, such as that he had always been Britain's greatest friend, that he had supplied the British Army with operational plans against the Boers, which he and his general staff had drawn up for them, and that the German Navy represented no threat to Britain whatsoever. It was instead directed against Japan and China and the Asian Yellow Peril. Well, this interview, before it could be published, had to be countersigned and approved by the Chancellor at the time, whose name was Bernhard von Bülow. And he did. And the publication of that interview resulted in an almost unanimous howl from the German public, calls, if not for his abdication, for at least the trimming, significant trimming of his powers. In other words, constitutional reform in the direction of a parliamentary monarchy. Well, in reaction to this, Wilhelm did retreat. His public interventions became less frequent, less loud, and less provocative. It's as if he'd had his tail wagged, or his tail beaten, and he became less prone to doing these kinds of things. I say this in part because of one aspect of this, and this is the behavior of Bülow, who was the chancellor and was constitutionally responsible for signing off on this public statement. When Bülow told the parliament that he had not had a chance to check it off and simply let it go across his desk, he was lying. He had read it. And the question becomes, why did he nonetheless allow the publication of it, if not to embarrass the Kaiser? In other words, it was in a sense a form of embarrassment that Bülow was trying to inflict on his own sovereign. I say this because it's just one notable aspect of the prospect of the truth that the manipulated were doing, in fact, the manipulation. We're doing those who were supposed to be manipulation. All right. Bülow was succeeded in the summer of 1909 by Bethmann Hollweg, who had by this time pursued a rather classical a bureaucratic career up through the various offices of the Ministry of the Interior and the Office of Interior. So he's known to be a very cautious, melancholy, and careful man, much more so than Bülow, who had made his career by flattering the Kaiser. Well, one of the things that Bethmann did was to realize the wisdom of withholding a lot of things from the press, from William's attention. In other words, he began to withhold information. And he was certainly not the only one who did so. Among those others who withheld information from him, and this I've concluded from some of my own work, were the leading soldiers, in that the full specifics of the Schlieffen Plan were not shared, I'm convinced, with the Kaiser before they went into operation. You may be familiar with the famous reproach that William gave in late July 1914 to the chief of his general staff, Helmut von Moltke the Younger. He said that when Moltke told him that the German army could not disband its plan for a war and attack only Russia because they didn't have any plan but one that envisaged an attack against both France and Russia. And William was appalled, and he said, well, your great uncle wouldn't have told me that, which suggests that indeed he did not know the specifics of the Schlieffen Plan. So I'm only going to say about this is that it got out, certainly amongst the top leadership, civilian leadership, and military leadership in Germany, that you have to be careful on what you tell the Kaiser. Okay.
So now let's talk about 1918, because of course
1918.
Ludendorff get not 1918 because Ludendorff gets his famous collapse, and there is a famous story asking sorry, Christopher Clark did recite very later under the Kaiser's exile, telling something. I don't remember what he said exactly, but he said something, and then the Kaiser replies back, like, "Well, you are the one who got a breakdown in 1918 and kind of roast him back in sense." I think it's something about Hitler, what he said, it said something about Hitler in the later years. And then he said, the Kaiser replied the words that well, you are the one who had the collapse in the 1918. But I want to talk about the abdication, because there is, of course, a story surrounding this as well. And the famous kind of, not really the revolution, I would say, but when the Weimar, newly founded Weimar Republic, goes in and says to the Kaiser that he has to abdicate. But he does try to become that. Maybe move his way around this, I believe, by saying that maybe he should become a constitutional monarch and not and give up the title emperor or kaiser, and then become just king of Prussia, of Germany. But of course, as we know, he will abdicate. But he does seem to try to still find a way to keep his power as a constitutional monarch before he finally realizes that he has to abdicate.
Before you can come to 1918, it seems to me that you have to go back to 1914 and then look at what happened in the interim, because the abdication and the circumstances of the abdication make more sense if you know what happened to him in the meantime.
Of course.
Should we talk about the July
Yeah,
crisis?
we can talk briefly about it. Yeah.
Okay. Keep it in mind that the position of Fritz Fischer had been that the major decisions had been made by Bethmann Hollweg for totally aggressive purposes, and that the Kaiser had to be, in a sense, dragged along. Well, we know now, thanks in part to Chris Clark as well, pretty intimately what happened in those days between the assassination and the outbreak of war. And William had said, oh, sorry.
If I may interrupt you for a second, I've got to ask, of course, what do you think about the Tuchman's work on 1914 and Guns of August? I've got to ask, what is your view on that for her work?
Well, I'll say this. I read that book in the early 60s when it first came out, and it was my first glimpse into this whole thing. And I was just riveted by the book. I mean, it's a real page turner. The book had come out after the Fisher dispute had begun, but she took, as I recall, no notice of it at all. So that it was a question here that she accepted the still dominant view that the blame for the outbreak of the First World War did not belong with Germany alone, but that it was shared by all of the powers. And in this way, she's able to go from capital to capital with the narrative.
And again, if I may bring up something she wrote, and of course that would resonate with Kennedy, is that after World War I, they would ask like, some, I don't remember who, but there's some that someone would ask, like, how did they come to this? And again, I don't remember the person who recited this, but they would say, oh, I don't remember. And that kind of stuck with Kennedy as well later. That he didn't want this case when the Cuban Missile Crisis came. That he didn't want someone to ask later, how did it come to this? Oh, well, I don't remember.
I don't remember that.
I do believe there's some famous line in Tuchman's book that cites something along, and again, it's a while since I read the book, but I don't remember. And that's why I'm not a historian. But there's something along the lines of this.
It's been 60 years since I've read it, so.
That's fair enough. Yeah, but yeah. Back to the. I just wanted to ask about what your thoughts on Tocqueville's work, because it's kind of, I felt that it was kind of relevant into the situation.
If you look at with the stuff that's now being published on the origins of the First World War, you will not find Tuchman's book cited. It was a very influential and very well received book at the time, but it's not an original piece of scholarship.
So that's, again, before we go into 1919 and the application, you wanted to talk about what you wanted to talk about before we dropped a little bit the rail, and I apologize again for doing that, but let's talk a little bit about the 1914 to 1918 as well.
Okay. Do you want to start with the July crisis and William's role in it?
Yes, please.
Okay. It was days after, and not weeks after, the assassination that Wilhelm assured the Austrian ambassador in Berlin that no matter what the Austrians did, the Germans would stand with him. This he said on his own. And that at least gave the Austrians reason to think that if they were to move in any military way against the Serbs, they would have the backing of their allies. Now, in a sense, to make this official, the Austrians sent an emissary to Potsdam. In early July, this was Hoyos, and Hoyos and the Austrian ambassador then met not only with William but also with Waidmann Holweg, and a number of other leading German civilians and soldiers, although not with Moltke nor with Tirpitz, both of whom were not there. But the Germans' leadership discussed it now amongst themselves, and under Bateman's leadership, they agreed with the Kaiser's position that the Germans would support the Austrians. Certainly, the leading German soldier at the meeting, this was Falkenhayn, who was then the Minister of War, agreed because he thought a general war was inevitable. But the Germans counseled the Austrians that they should, in fact, move militarily against the Serbs, but that they should do so quickly while international public opinion was still so upset over the assassination of the Archduke, and the Austrians could count on some considerable international sympathy if they were to move to punish the Serbs. The Austrians did not move quickly. They had their own problems, particularly in assuring the consent of the Hungarians for this whole thing. All the while, the Germans were screaming at them, "Would you please get something out?" They knew that some kind of ultimatum was in the works. And when it happened, the Serbs responded in a somewhat encouraging manner that they would be able to accept many aspects of the ultimatum. And when William heard this news, he said, "Oh, well, we don't need to have a war after all." And well, the Bateman Hollweg made sure that this did not get into German policy, and he did not encourage the Austrians to make their own positive response to the Serbian response. And then, in the end, as I mentioned a moment ago, William also said, as the Germans were about to announce their mobilization plan, "Well, we don't have to go to war with France if Britain is going to keep France from fighting us, and it looked to William at that point as that was going to happen, we can simply fight the Russians alone. And at this point, he was informed now by Moltke that that was not possible.
We should also mention, if I may,
yeah.
We should also mention that France and Russia, of course, have signed an alliance of either their attack that
Yes,
would be,
I should have
would
mentioned
be
that.
where they would attack the aggressor,
Yeah.
which of course initiate, I imagine, is Germany.
William's behavior during the July crisis did not suggest that he was the driving force behind the German reaction to the crisis, that this was being formulated elsewhere, and that there is good reason to believe that it was principally Bethmann Hollweg who was in the driver's seat about all of this. In any event, the war broke out. Okay, we can agree on that. The war broke out, and at that point, William II became the commander in chief of the German army. And the question is, how would he react to this challenge? And the answer was, and it became clear almost immediately, he was totally, totally over his head. He had not the slightest idea of what he should be doing, aside from making speeches. So what happened was that the military direction of the war devolved into the hands of the chief of the general staff, Helmut von Moltke, while the chief responsibility for civilian affairs became the charge of Bethmann Hollweg and the Ministry of War, which began to work out the bureaucratic guidelines for administering the home front. The remarkable thing about this whole thing is how very little a role Wilhelm played in either of these theaters. Moltke lasted a couple of months. He had a nervous breakdown himself in the course of the Battle of the Marne and had to be replaced. The choice of a successor was Williams. And he asked around, but took, in a sense, the guy who was most at hand, and that was Falkenhayn, and soon became dependent for most of what he knew about the operations on Falkenhayn himself, and was thus very dependent on Falkenhayn for what he knew about the war. This, despite the fact that Falkenhayn was making enemies tooth over nail himself, and amid much pressure, popular, military, and civilian, to dump him. William was reluctant to dump him because he knew that the only people who would be credible candidates as successors were going to be Hindenburg and Ludendorff. And William feared, rightly so, that they had already replaced him as kind of the focus of loyalty and admiration in the German ruling scheme of things. And he was right about that, but he saw no alternative in the summer of 1916 to appointing the two military heroes who were in charge of the war effort for the rest of the war. What this means to say is that William increasingly became an irrelevant factor in the German prosecution of the war. His headquarters were pretty well encapsulated off. The soldiers who did know about the war were reluctant to inform him, so that he was pretty well ignorant. We have lots of testimonies as to the atmosphere of dreadful boredom that reigned in the imperial headquarters in which William resided. as if there were no war going on at all. He himself was not subject to rations. He ate well. He drank well. They spent away their days listening to Wilhelm rant and playing Scott. So it was an atmosphere of dreadful boredom. So that when the demand was made that Wilhelm abdicate, there were very few people in the leadership who were opposed to the idea. So that Wilhelm might say, "Well, if I can't stay on as emperor, I'll stay on as king of Prussia," and nobody was willing to go for that either. And it wasn't until the end that they figured out that the only way they could get him to abdicate is to have Hindenburg tell him, "Sir, you no longer have the confidence of your own army." And he had no answer for that question. And at that point, he agreed.
I want to talk a little bit before we talk about the real application of Allied propaganda on Wilhelm II, because they really worked hard to demonize. And of course, this is what we talked about in the very beginning of this podcast, that the Allied propaganda really helped demonize and set the tone for Wilhelm II, maybe almost until for the half most of 20th century, and that it would set be what people would think of Wilhelm II when they heard about him. So let's talk a little bit about the Allied propaganda on Wilhelm and how they demonized him.
I think you're right about this. And I can only say that Wilhelm made it really easy for the British and the French to portray him as a monster. All they had to do, and all they really did do, was to go back and read his own speeches, in which he's saying these terrible things about just about everything and everybody. But it also allowed them to portray him as the evil spirit behind the German behavior in Belgium and northern France during the first weeks of the First World War, that the so-called Belgian atrocities were his responsibility. And there were, in fact, horrible things that German troops did on their way towards the first battles of the First World War. Whether or not they were quite as systematic and quite as bloodthirsty and quite as arrogant as they were made out to be is the subject of an ongoing dispute even today. But Wilhelm by this time had made himself an extraordinarily inviting target for Allied propaganda. And if then found very, very rich soil in the United States, where the popular opinion outside of the Midwest, where most of the German settlement had taken place, was very much on the side of the Entente powers. And this is why my mother thought that Kaiser Wilhelm ate Belgian babies for breakfast.
I mean, not natural. But let's talk about this abdication, because, and I want to do a comparison, if I may, with the Romanovs, where there was, when they abdicated, they were talking about sending them to Norway or England, but nobody really wanted to have them, have the Romanovs, when they tried to escape Russia after they had their abdication. But where there was a similar problems with Wilhelm, when he had to flee Russia, flee Germany, was there any issues with? Oh no, he ended up, of course, in Holland, as we now know, but was there disputes with countries that, oh no, we don't want him here, we don't want him in exile, as an exile in our country? Were there any such troubles as there were with the Romanovs when they had to abdicate the throne?
Well, I should think, if anything, it would be even more difficult. First of all, what countries are you thinking of that would have taken him? Well, I suppose maybe Norway or the Scandinavian country, but Holland was the first choice, because it lay only a couple of kilometers away from his headquarters
I mean,
in
if I may, Sweden did have fairly good relations with Germany after the Second World War, so they would have been kind of a reasonable country to choose, right? Because they had good relations with Germany.
I honestly don't know of any negotiations beyond which those that developed quickly between the Dutch Queen and Wilhelm. And he had a relation or a friend who offered him to take him up in her estate. And there was a big house called the Huusdoorn next door that he was able then to buy a year and a half later and to settle in. But I think it probably would have been, I'm only speculating here, that it would have been more attractive for him in Holland than perhaps any other place. And certainly, as far as logistics were concerned, it was an obvious choice.
Whether when he went into exile, were the danger of for his life that he would people try to were angry at him for losing the war, or were the dangers of assassinations when they had to escape Germany?
Well, there was at the initial stages of his flight from Belgium, there was a lot of anxiety on his part, but also on his own retinue that he would be killed by socialist troops, German troops.
The Free Corps at this point, or is that
They're
still
not
the
free. They're not free corps, but he's worried about the left wing troops. So what they did was they sent him out in a train, but very quickly stopped the train and got him out and put him in a car and drove then to the Dutch border while the train went on to the same place in an attempt to mislead any potential wrongdoers. So yeah, he was afraid for his life.
So let's talk about this years in exile, because he lives quite a long time after his abdication until 1941 during the Second World War. So let's talk about his life in exile, what he is doing with his time. And of course, when Hitler came to power, I want to talk a little bit about as well, because he does become an anti-Semite. I'm not sure if he was this during his reign of the throne, but he does become an anti-Semite as well a little bit, because
He was.
He
He
blames
was.
the Jews for the loss after World War One, as Christopher Clark writes about, that he does blame the Jews, and that he and yeah, he kind of buys into this myth that they stabbed us in the back on the First World War and at the home front. And so let's talk a little bit about this anti-Semitism as well after his abdication. And I'm not sure if he was much of an anti-Semite during his reign, but he would become an anti-Semite at least
Well,
after his education.
I can answer that question is that he was an anti-Semite before the war. John Rohrl, again, has written or has discovered reams and reams and reams of statements that were anti-Semitic. Now, admittedly, he did have some Jewish friends, but he was never above the which we say the staple prejudices against Jews that were common in Imperial Germany. So, but by no stretch of the imagination can he not be called an anti-Semite. But it became increasingly, how do I want to say, increasingly loud, increasingly prominent as he did leave power. And then, as he, in a sense, rotted away the rest of his life in Holland, and certainly by the end, after the coming to power of the Nazis, there was no disguising it.
He does seem to oppose Hitler a little bit at first, but when he sees what he's doing when he's winning the world war in the first phase of the Second World War, he does seem to be rather impressed. Maybe not of Hitler himself, but his military achievements at least.
Okay, let's be clear on this. his principal concern, in fact, his only concern after he went into exile, was to be returned to the throne, or at least have one of his sons return to the throne. This was his principal interest in German politics, which he followed very closely, and so did his sons. His initial impressions of the Nazis were not particularly impressed. They seemed like a bunch of rabble-rousers, but only after Hitler began to emerge as a major force in German politics did Wilhelm begin to take him seriously. How? As a route to William's own return. In other words, his principal hope of Hitler was that he could persuade Hitler to bring him back to the throne. There were many, many pilgrimages of leading Nazis to Dorn. Goering, amongst them, others, was a frequent visitor. And the subject was always, what are the Nazis going to do to bring me back to power? And of course, Hitler knew not to deny this. He had never had any intention of restoring the monarchy.
He called him a fool at some point.
He thought he was a fool. Now, William, like many other skeptics about the Nazi regime, were favorably impressed between 1939 and 1941, between the conquest of Poland and up until the summer of 41, when the Russian campaign started to go haywire. Wilhelm took pride in the fact that the leaders of Hitler's armies were young officers in his own army, and that in a sense he, William, had trained them for their great destiny. In other words, he tried to take as much credit for Hitler's successes as he could.
So let's talk about this step, because as we know, he wanted to be buried only if in Germany, only if the monarchy came back. And of course, to this day, there's still no monarchy in Germany, so he is still resting in Holland to this day, because he did not want to be buried back on German soil until Germany became a monarchy again.
I don't know what the exact circumstances were, but I can see why the Nazis might have been reluctant to see him buried on German soil as well, in part because he still had sons who had a claim to the German throne. Besides, when the monarch died, there were other exciting things going on.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about his sons, because they haven't been much spotlight in this episode, but were his sons, when the Nazis came to power, were they committed Nazis, or were they as well skeptics to the Nazi regime?
Two in particular of his sons are important in this regard. The one is August Wilhelm. I think he was the third or fourth of the sons. He was the most committed of the Nazis. He was a member of the Nazi party. He made no secret of his sympathies public before 1933. The other one has been the subject of a great deal of controversy in Germany of late, and this was the first of the sons, Crown Prince Wilhelm himself, who has been, it has now been shown conclusively that he was very much complicit in the popularization of Hitler's movement, that he himself actually joined a number of Nazi organizations. And then after 1933, he appeared, for one thing, at the Day of Potsdam in March of 1933, alongside Hitler and Hindenburg, that he was at a number of Hitler's great rallies endorsing the regime. Those are the two principal ones. About the opinions of the rest of them, I can't say very much.
I think we're gonna round it up there. Well, but I want to ask before you go, what do you think is the legacy of Wilhelm II, and how do you think compared to what people, of course, see this and listen to this episode, but read more recent work on Wilhelm II? What do you think? How has opinion of Wilhelm changed over the centuries after World War I until today?
This is a fair and interesting question, because if you look at the alternative interpretations that have been available about the Kaiser, it hasn't been a particularly flattering range, has it? From being a monster, to being a moron, to being irrelevant. Now, none of them is anything that I would hope would be said about me in looking back, and I'm say I think it's worth noting that this has been an issue in German politics in the last couple of years. Let me just say for a moment about this: the Hohenzollern dynasty is making a claim for properties that they owned that were confiscated after 1945 by the Soviet regime, but then were in a sense repatriated to the Germans in 1989. And they're claiming that they still have the legal title to a lot of these properties, the most famous of which is Sicilienhof in Potsdam, where the Potsdam Conference met in 1945. This is now, it's a public piece of property, but there are lots of art collections. There are museum items, all of which the Hohenzollern dynasty is now trying to sue the German government to get restored. So that the whole thought of the Hohenzollern dynasty, what it has meant for Germany, and in particular, the role of the German crown prince in bringing the Nazis to power has been a subject of intense and broad discussion, not only among historians, but in the broader public as well. It appears to have reached a resolution in which the Hohenzollerns have lost on all fronts.
What is your thoughts? Do you feel that the Hohenzollern, current Hohenzollerns, have the right to the artwork and property inside the palace, or do you feel like it's now but it should belong to the public?
My own view is no, certainly morally and culturally, although the verdict was ultimately based on a legal clause in the German law that governed the repatriated things in 1989. And this was that all of these things will be restored to people who did not play a significant role in the coming of a dictatorship after the Second World War, and by which they included both the Nazis and the East German dictatorship. And this turned the Crown Prince William into the main character of interest, because he was the one whose role was most prominent, and he because he was the heir apparent to the throne. And the current head of the Hohenzollern family was distressed by the way in which historians began to talk about the Hohenzollern dynasty, and he tried to shut them up legally as well. A number of my friends have run up very large legal expenses in trying to defend themselves against the lawyers of the Hohenzollern dynasty. One in particular, a man by the name of Stefan Melanowski, has published a book in the last couple of years about the Nazis and the Hohenzollern, and he has shown beyond the faintest doubt of the critical role that was played by the Crown Prince in the coming of the Nazis to power, and that he had lent the moral a prestige of his own name and that of his dynasty to the Hitler movement. And in some sectors of the German population in the 1920s and early 1930s, this was very, very important indeed.
They don't seem like friendly lads, these German Hohenzollerns, do they?
I'm sorry?
They don't seem like friendly lads, the German Hohenzollerns, do they?
No. The Hohenzollern dynasty does not enjoy a particularly good rap nowadays, as we would say.
Thank you so much for coming. I think we're going to round it up there. Before you go, do you have anything you want to promote or so social media where people might find you if they have any questions? Or, of course, do you have a current book coming out soon? If you want to promote that one, you can do so. Or if you have previous books you want to write,
Well,
please do not hesitate and I will help you out here.
get ready for it. In August, from the Cambridge University Press, will come a book entitled The German Empire, 1871 to 1918, with my humble self as the author. I have no idea how much they're going to charge. I'd like to think it will be available as a paperback, but we'll see.
Thank you again so much for coming. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you today. And my name is Anand. This has been Well.h12. We are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on Spotify, consider giving us 5 stars. That would help us out a lot. You can also give us 1, though I would prefer if you gave us 5. That would be very nice. If you are on Apple Podcasts, consider giving us 5 stars there as well. And please consider giving a review of the podcast, and I will try to read it on the podcast as well if I can find it. Also, if you are on YouTube, please like, share, and subscribe. On social media, we are available on Twitter and Instagram and Well.h12. Please like, share, and subscribe. My name is Alan, and I will see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.